The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Last week, I started talking about the Four Noble Truths, and I'd like to continue that. I kind of began an overview, and I'd like to explore a little more in detail today the First Noble Truth. But before I do that, I'll just offer a little recap of the Four Noble Truths, just to get us all together on the same page. So, when the Buddha left home on his quest for freedom, he was really looking for freedom from suffering. That was his whole direction in his search. That he saw that just living life, that people suffer. And he wondered whether it was possible to be free of that. And so that was his search, that was his quest, that was his orientation. His whole orientation was around this question of what is suffering and is it possible to be free of it? And so it's not surprising that the core fundamental teaching that he offers and the core insight that he had the night that he had his experience of awakening is framed around suffering. So the Four Noble Truths are all related to this question of suffering. The First Noble Truth is basically the statement, there is suffering. This is a truth. This happens in our lives, that we find ourselves struggling, stressed, with feelings of dissatisfaction, unease. So that this is true. Everybody going through a human existence will experience this at some point or another. The second noble truth is that he understood, he found that this suffering that we experience has a cause. It's not random. It's not fortuitous. It is caused by something happening in our minds. So the kind of suffering of the First Noble Truth, the suffering of the First Noble Truth, you know, we might think of it as just being unpleasant experience, you know, that might be what our understanding of what suffering is. I mean, certainly when we are experiencing unpleasantness, often we're unhappy about it. But the definition of what the Buddha talked about in this First Noble Truth, the truth of dukkha, the truth of suffering, dukkha being the Pali term for, that's usually translated as suffering. I'll probably slip into using that word, so I wanted to put it out there. That the suffering, the dukkha of this First Noble Truth is not so much about painful experience as it is our mind's response to experience. That we're not usually simply at ease with things as they are happening in the world. We either want things to go away because they're unpleasant, or fix them or change them, or we want to hold on to things that are pleasant. So we rarely are just simply at ease with things as they are. We're almost always in some kind of reaction to them. And that reactivity is the kernel of what the Buddha meant by this dukkha, this First Noble Truth of suffering. And this suffering, this kind of suffering, has a cause in our own minds, which is basically the cause of not being able to be at ease with things as they are. Essentially, the wanting things to be other than they are. And that's, the Buddha understood that this wanting things to be different, that's actually the cause of our struggles, of our suffering. Then the question was, well, is it possible? Is it possible to be free of suffering? And he, in his mind, I mean, he was kind of an analytical person based on my take of the Buddha, based on what I've read in the Buddhist texts. He was a pretty analytical guy. And he said, okay, this is the cause of suffering, this wanting things to be other than they are. If it were possible to let go of that wanting things to be other than they are, suffering would come to an end. So that became his question then. Is it possible to release that wanting? To release the wish that things be some other way than they actually are? And he found for himself that this was possible. That it was possible to be free of this. The term is often talked about as craving. Wanting is a mild version of that. Craving, I think, gives a deeper sense of the term. That's the cause of suffering. It's a craving. We have the feeling of having to have something be a certain way. With wanting, we sometimes have a sense, it's like, well, it could be that way or it could not be. It almost feels a little bit like preference. The wanting of that's the cause of suffering has a sense of it's not okay that it's not the way I want it. That craving, that sense of it has to be the way I want it to be. So this is what he identified as the cause and the possibility of the release from that craving. He found to be the case that he could free himself from that craving, that wanting things to be other than they are. And in this process of discovery, he also found so let me step back for a moment. So the wanting, the statement that suffering has a cause. That's the second noble truth. That there is a cause. A truth of the cause of suffering. The third noble truth is the statement that it's possible to be free of that. The truth of the ending of suffering. And the fourth noble truth is the truth that there is a path that we can cultivate that will support us in finding our way to this freedom from suffering, this ending of this craving for ourselves. The path being the Noble Eightfold Path. Wise understanding, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. These are essentially tools or practices that the Buddha offers us and says, cultivate these tools. They will support you to understand suffering, to let go of its cause, and to realize the ending of suffering for yourselves. So this was his orientation, this exploration of dukkha, of suffering. And so tonight I'd like to explore this question of dukkha, of suffering, what it is, how the Buddha understood it, as I understand how the Buddha understood it. See how far we get tonight. So I think I said some of this last week, but I'll also repeat this aspect of kind of a clarification around dukkha, this term dukkha. So translated as suffering, the word dukkha. When we think of the word suffering, we often think of kind of big things, you know? It's like, you know, car crashes and tsunamis and earthquakes and partners dying or parents getting Alzheimer's. You know, these are the things that we would call suffering. But this word dukkha has much broader meaning than that kind of suffering. It covers a much wider range. So, you know, if just using the word suffering, sometimes people, just the other day I was talking to somebody who said they were having a conversation and somebody said, well, I don't suffer, but I'd like to be happier. So that feeling of not quite being as happy as we'd like to be, that's a form of dukkha. There's another story from Steve Armstrong, who's a teacher in this tradition. He typically teaches in Hawaii, and well, he teaches all over the country. And on his very first retreat, he actually wound up at a retreat center, kind of mistakenly. You know, he read in a, it was like this, you know, this retreat in Maine, and he pictured massages and, you know, he pictured walks in the woods and things like that. And he stumbled into this meditation retreat with very structured schedule. You know, you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you sit and walk all day, you know, don't talk to anybody. And you know, in the evenings there's this Dharma talk. And he's sitting back there listening. You know, to his credit, he didn't leave. You know, he's kind of befuddled, I think, by this whole thing that was going on. But he said he sat back there at the back of the room and he kind of listened to this talk, these talks about suffering. And he said he was sitting there and his body hurt and he was kind of frustrated and, you know, a little irritated that he'd stumbled into this thing instead of what he'd thought it was. And he heard them talking about suffering. And he said, well, I don't have any of that. All of that, all of what he was experiencing, all of that frustration, that irritation, the body pain, the reactivity to that body pain, that was all dukkha. So the term has a much broader range of meaning. And there's some other terms. Tanisaro Bhikkhu, one of the translators of the suttas, and he authors some of the books, some of the free books that we have for distribution here. He likes to use the term stress as a translation for dukkha. And I like this term because for a couple reasons. One is that it points to the fact, I mean, when we think of stress, we usually think of something that's happening in our minds. When we think of suffering, sometimes we think of things that are happening out there. Stress is pretty clear as happening inside. You know, we talk about being stressed. It also conveys some of the subtler aspects of this term dukkha. You know, we talk about being stressed when we, you know, have maybe a little bit too much to do or we're rushed and not able to do things as we'd like to do them. So that's another translation that we can think of for dukkha is this term stress. Another one that I like is dissatisfaction. When we just are not satisfied with things as they are, when we're not satisfied with what's happening, that's a form of dukkha. Unease. If we just have a subtle sense of things are a little off, that's a form of dukkha. So some of these other translations can help us understand this term. So dukkha, as I said a little while ago, dukkha doesn't mean unpleasantness. So there's, you know, physical pain in our body. Physical, you know, if we cut ourselves with a knife or fall down and break a leg, something like that, we'll have pain in the body. And that physical pain isn't what the Buddha meant by dukkha. The Buddha had a bad back. And I think I said this last week, that sometimes he had to ask one of his monks to give the Dharma talk because his back was hurting so much that he couldn't sit up. So the physicality of the human body produces pain. And that's completely normal. That's not going to go away. That is not, freedom from suffering doesn't mean freedom from physical unpleasant experience. Unfortunately, I hate to tell you that, but the good news is that it does, that the freedom from suffering would mean that we were free from all reactivity to physical pain. So just imagine what that might be like. You know, if you break your leg, there's the physicality, there's the pain of it, but there's not any mental contraction around it. It might be hard to envision that, to be in physical pain without having a mental contraction around it. There are times in meditation that we can begin to really touch into the physicality of our body and the experience of pleasant and unpleasant in our bodies. And in that exploration, there have been times when my mind has been settled enough to simply be able to meet what I would typically, in a normal state of mind, call painful experience. You know, pain in the knee or pain in the leg. But at certain times in meditation, the mind can be so settled that it is completely non-reactive to that pain. And it's just, oh, wow, that strong, unpleasant experience. And the mind is not rebelling or reacting or doing anything with it. It just notices that. Okay, yeah, that's strong, unpleasant experience. And in that recognition, what I was surprised about in that recognition is that strong, unpleasant experience didn't really have the characteristic of what I would usually call pain. Because a lot of what we actually call pain has to do with our reaction. There's such a tight feedback loop between the mind and the body that when there is physical pain, the mind rebels, pulls back. The body often contracts. So there's a kind of a feedback loop that happens around pain. And that feedback loop can tend to reinforce the pain. It can make the pain in the body stronger because we're kind of tightening and pulling around it. And it's compounded by a mental reactivity, by an aversion to the experience. This has been very interesting for me to watch this in my meditation, to see when there is unpleasant experience, noticing when there's aversion in the mind, and when the aversion drops away. What a different experience there is in the body when the aversion falls away. So this physical pain is not the dukkha. It is our mental reactivity to it that is the dukkha. Then there is the mental realm as well. So the aversion itself is unpleasant, and we can tend to react to that with anger, frustration, irritation, compounding our mental reaction with more unpleasantness. The Buddha talked about unpleasant experience and this mental reactivity being, he gave an analogy. He said, it's just as if somebody has been hit by a dart or an arrow. And then they pick up an arrow and they stab themselves again. The first arrow is the physical pain. It's unavoidable. The second arrow, or third, or fourth, or fifth, is our own mental reactivity to that pain. And it is a process that happens in our own minds. And this is really what the good news is. I mean, maybe it doesn't sound like good news that we cause ourselves suffering, but the good news is that because it's a process that happens in our own mind, it's a process that can be undone in our own minds. We can begin to see how it's created. And that very seeing of it with mindfulness begins to allow us to let go of it. It's a process. By seeing how the mind creates its own struggles, when the mind sees that it's creating its own painful experience, it starts to let go of it. It actually isn't something we have to do to let go of it. It's a natural unfolding by being willing to be mindful of our experience, being willing to be mindful of our dukkha, turning towards our painful experience. So this mental distress, you know, this second arrow, we will add third, fourth, fifth, sixth arrows to that, reacting to our reactions. This is very familiar to us. I mean, we all know how we, you know, something happens, and we don't like it, and then we get frustrated, and then we get angry, and then we get irritated, then we get sad that we're so caught in all of this mess, and then we get whatever. It compounds itself. So the mental distress covers a range of experiences. I'm going to name some of them here. I've got a list. of some kinds of mental dukkha. Disturbance, irritation, dejection, worry, despair, fear, dread, anguish, anxiety, desire, frustration, longing, aimlessness, striving, repression, wanting, insufficiency, dislike, aversion, vacillation, uncertainty. All of these are forms of mental agitation. Maybe some felt more strongly than others as suffering. So dukkha always lies in the realm of our mental struggle. It seems at times that it might be really difficult to be able to see how these struggles are created. That's actually been a lot of my exploration. What I've seen, how it works, is that as I begin to just be willing to meet my suffering, willing to meet the dukkha, willing to hang out with it, what seems to happen is that the mind starts to get attuned to that suffering. And it begins to be mindful, begin to kind of wake up and be present for that suffering earlier in the process of its creation, even to the point where we can see it coming into being. We might see a thought, for instance. You know, we see something. We see something in our world. We're walking down the street and we see a particular kind of tree. And that tree is just like a tree that we fell out of when we were a kid. And so the memory of falling out of the tree when we were a kid comes up. And then we start thinking about that. We start thinking about the fact that we fell out of a tree as a kid. And perhaps some of the fear or anxiety or painfulness of that situation comes back to us. And there in the present moment, we are reliving some pain. So we can start to see this whole process unfold with mindfulness if we're interested in exploring it. Typically, that whole unfolding, you know, what might be happening typically without the mindfulness is that we'd be walking down the street, we'd see that tree, and we wouldn't really notice that we saw the tree. We wouldn't really notice the thought cross our minds. We would just end up lost down this long train of thought, feeling sorry for ourselves because we didn't get to participate in that great event when we were 10 years old, and hasn't that happened over and over again in my life? We end up lost because we haven't seen this whole process unfolding. So with mindfulness, what I've seen happening with mindfulness in my experience is that it's as if, and I think it's more than as if, it seems to be really what happens, that the mindfulness allows the horizon of the subconscious to get lower and lower. I mean, much of what I described there would typically happen below the level of our conscious awareness, and we would just end up lost in this proliferation of thinking and wake up at some point kind of struggling around it. But with the mindfulness, the horizon of the subconscious begins to lower, and we can see actually this whole process starting. We might be able to see the fact that we were seeing a tree and see the memory flit through our mind. As we see this happen, as mindfulness sees it happening, the subconscious momentum doesn't have the power over us that it has when it's not seen. And so mindfulness really helps to kind of penetrate what typically happens in the subconscious, bring it into consciousness, and allow us to make some skillful choices around it. So we don't always see suffering as suffering. It can be masked because of the way our minds work. So if we're not liking something, you know, if there's states, you know, so those states that I read, the range of experiences that I read a little while ago, if we're in the aversive side of those states, the disliking, you know, aversion, frustration, irritation, annoyance, that kind of thing, we might not notice that experience as suffering. Because what we typically do in that kind of situation is we're focused outwards on the thing that we're irritated about or frustrated about or aversive to. We're focused outward in the world about it. And we're more focused on fixing or changing or controlling that than we are on the actual experience of suffering. The actual experience of what is it like to be a person who doesn't like this situation. So we tend to be outwardly focused on what's happening out there. And we may, in fact, miss that we are suffering for different reasons. So for instance, we might, in the seeing something out there that we think needs to be different or changed, we might in our minds project into the future of how great it's going to be when we fix this. So essentially what happens is that we're overriding what's happening now with a future fantasy. And that fantasy may be pleasant. I mean, we tend to do that. We, you know, tend to project ourselves into a future that might be more pleasant. So we are experiencing the kind of momentum towards that future that we've identified as being where we want to go. And we're missing what's happening here and now. So we've lost touch with the present moment. So that's one way that we might miss the fact that we are suffering when we are in states of aversion. Another way that I've seen myself missing suffering is when I was angry with a person and there was a sense of revenge that I had. You know, it's kind of like the anger felt like somehow I had the belief that that anger was going to hurt the other person. You know, that was going to make the other person miserable for me to be angry at them. And having that emphasis or that focus, I actually missed for a while the fact that the anger was burning me up because I was so focused on, yeah, he's going to be miserable that I'm so mad at him, you know. This actually got pretty obvious because I was angry with somebody who was living 7,000 miles away. So it didn't actually take me that long to realize that it wasn't going to do anything to him. But, I mean, it was kind of shocking to me and surprising to me when I saw that that was part of the motivation for that anger, was I thought somehow it was going to make him miserable. But what it was really doing was burning me up. Now, this is an insight to see how our, you know, states of dissatisfaction, of aversion themselves, to see that they are suffering. That's an insight. It doesn't feel very good. But when the mindfulness actually reveals that to us, our minds get an education in the fact that these states are not leading us to well-being. I mean, I think essentially we do act in ways that we hope are going to lead us to well-being. Somehow my mind had deluded itself into thinking that the anger was going to contribute to my being happier at some point. But it was taking me away from happiness here and now. The very state here was suffering here and now. And seeing that in the moment with mindfulness is an insight. When the mind can begin to recognize that, the mind itself begins to understand what it needs to do to move away from those states. We can explore a little bit of how to let go of those states. More often I've seen in my own experience with these kind of mental reactivity, that I can't just drop it, even seeing it with mindfulness. Knowing clearly, yep, there's anger, there's frustration. Even knowing it really clearly, I can't just drop it because there's so much momentum behind it. We've practiced these things so much in our lives that, you know, that it's a well-greased route. Our minds are just going to go right down that route, even being aware, being mindful of it. So what I've seen for myself is that the very being willing to be with those feelings, not to get caught in the story around, to let go of the story, to let go of the thoughts around it and come into the experience. What does it feel like to be a person that's angry? What does that feel like? That willingness begins to allow the anger to kind of begin to loosen. We get a little bit of space around the feeling, the difficulty, the aversion. We get a little space around it. And it allows that difficult emotion to live its life and to follow the laws of impermanence. It will eventually pass because we're not feeding it. We're no longer fueling it with all those thoughts and ideas and beliefs of what they should have done and they shouldn't have done and who I am and what I will be and what I wasn't and all of those stories that we tell ourselves that feed these difficulties. So the mindfulness begins to allow a letting go to happen. We don't have to do the letting go, but it's a trust. It's a trust in the practice that we need to cultivate, a trust that this is a direction that will be helpful. And we begin to even see that, even in early moments of being aware and mindful of dukkha. We start to see that space. We start to see a little bit of ease around our struggles. And we know this is helpful. This does lead to more well-being. So we explore, investigate our suffering. And one last piece, and I'll open it up for comments or questions. There's another side to the dukkha. There's the kind of the obvious kinds of suffering around the unpleasant side of the world, you know, the unpleasant side of experience, all of the aversive states. There's also some suffering around the pleasant side of experience. And I don't think I'm going to have enough time to go into this in great detail tonight. In fact, I think I'll cover that the next time I'm here. But there's a kind of suffering around wanting. You know, the very moment that wanting arises in our hearts, the very moment that we want something to be different than it is, there's a feeling of lack. There's a feeling that something's wrong or off. And it's the wanting itself that is the feeling of offness. So this wanting, the craving, the wishing things were other than it they are in this moment. This is not to say that we can't take action to do something. And what I'm talking about is in this moment, things are here right now. And typically what the dukkha is about this is not okay right now. It's already here. You know, it's already happening. You might as well accept what's already here and then see if we can step forward into the next moment skillfully. That skillful movement helps us to move more towards well-being in the future, more towards non-suffering in the future. And I'll talk about that more, I think, next week or the next time I'm here. So this wanting itself has a feeling of offness, A feeling, the wanting brings up a feeling of dissatisfaction, and that dissatisfaction itself is dukkha. It actually feels unpleasant. The wanting itself, if we actually begin to recognize and turn towards the feeling of wanting, it doesn't feel very good. And again, the mind and body knows this is not well-being. This wanting is not well-being. And the only way that we have learned, typically, to satisfy or to have there be more well-being when there's wanting is to get the thing that we want, is to have the thing that we want, to get rid of the dissatisfaction by being satisfied. That's what we've learned. That's been a kind of an easy way, in effect, to get rid of the unpleasantness of wanting is to have the thing that we want. And we've learned that over and over again in our lives. We've learned that we get a little bit of happiness when we get what we want. The Buddha's proposal is that actually it's the wanting itself that's the struggle. And that if we can let go of the wanting, there won't be a problem. When the wanting releases, the feeling of dissatisfaction goes away. When the wanting releases, the feeling that there's something that I need goes away. So this wanting itself is often masked for us. It's often a kind of suffering that we don't recognize as suffering. Mostly, again, because we're projected out onto the thing that we want, focused on the satisfaction it's going to give us when we have it. So we don't even think of looking at the wanting. We're just focused on getting the thing that we want. So we're creating an idea of happiness in the future. This leaning into having what we want. We're creating an idea of that my life is going to be so much better when I have that thing. And again, we're living in the happiness of that idea. We're missing the fact that we are not having happiness here and now. And we are willing to sacrifice this happiness, well-being here and now, for the sake of a few moments of happiness in the future. Over and over again, we are willing to do that. It's quite amazing when we look at our minds and how they work. So we tolerate the unpleasantness of the wanting because of this idea of a future happiness. We actually often don't even recognize the unpleasantness of the wanting. And so again, the exploration, turn towards this wanting. Explore, what does it feel like to want something? See if you can explore that instead of acting on it. You might try this week sometime. If you find yourself wanting something small, perhaps, something that, you know, it wouldn't threaten you too much to do without, like, you know, a candy bar or a bowl of ice cream or something, you know. Just see what happens if you just explore the feeling of wanting around it. Can you just be with that wanting without acting on it? What happens? What you might notice is that, you know, you just sit there with the feeling of wanting and then something else comes into your mind and you forget about the wanting. And then you go off and you drive away and a little while later it's like, oh, I didn't have that ice cream and where did the wanting go? You know, so you might find that you just kind of forget about the wanting. If you at some point can actually explore, I mean, so that's a great exploration to make, actually, just explore the wanting and see what happens to you around that. Sometimes when you make this exploration, you might actually see the wanting go away. For myself, I've seen this in simple ways, you know, sitting at a corner with a stoplight, a Starbucks on the other side of the street. The mind creates the idea of a latte. That would be good. I'd like a latte. Sitting at the light, seeing the Starbucks. Long enough time for me to see, oh, this is wanting. Okay. I'm not going to act on this. But as long as the Starbucks is right in front of me, that wanting is there. You know, the mind, the Starbucks keeps creating the image of the latte in my mind. So it's just, okay, there it is, wanting. As soon as the light turns green and I turn the corner and manage to drive past the Starbucks, The wanting goes away. You know, you can see, if you can see that wanting go away, it's like out of sight, out of mind, in a way, is what happens. You know, as soon as the Starbucks was out of my field of vision, poof, it was like, poof, the wanting for the latte disappeared. That release from the wanting can feel like being released from a vice grip. And that feeling brings a great sense of well-being, that release from wanting. And it's a well-being that comes not from having something, but from letting go. It's kind of a more profound or deeper kind of happiness that comes from letting go. So, what are your thoughts? Your comments or questions or...
So you talked about physical sensations and how the mind can get through them or release the pain that may come from them or something. Like if you were meditating and your leg was...
It's the mental reactivity.
Right.
The pain, it's the physical sensation. Physical sensations stay, but there's a release around the reactivity.
So what about something like, like anxiety can cause jitteriness or sadness can make you feel like you're made of lead. These are like physical sensations that come from mental states.
Yes. So there's it's a feedback loop between the mind and the body. So the body produces experience. We react to that with emotions. Those emotions themselves produce physical sensations, which often compound the original sensation. I had at one point I had a frozen shoulder. This is a little bit different than what you're describing, but it kind of is in the terrain. So there was the pain in the shoulder, and there was kind of a sense of what it felt like actually. You know, was that the entire body kind of felt inflamed. The shoulder couldn't move very well, and this lasted for almost a year that this was the case. So I really had a lot of chance to observe the mind-body interaction between the frozen shoulder and how my mind reacted to it. And it really felt like the entire body felt inflamed. And I had some thought in my mind of, well, you know, there's this inflammation in the shoulder. It's been in my body a long time. Maybe it's kind of, you know, spilling out into the rest of the physical inflammation. Maybe it's spilling into the rest of my body. At one point, I saw just through being mindful, you know, of the experience of the body and the mind, I saw a little tiny, there was just a moment of the mind going, releasing, just a subtle release around tightening or tensing or contracting around the pain. And in that moment, in that split second, the irritation in the whole rest of the body vanished. And then it came right back because the mind went clamped down again. But I saw in that moment that how the entire kind of reactivity of the rest of the body was mental, was associated with the mind clamping down, and how it released with the mind letting go. So there, that feedback loop between mind and body is very, very potent, very powerful. And so there will be feedback from emotions. I mean, anger to me has feelings of pressure and heat rising through the body. You know, sadness feels like heaviness or contraction in the throat, or fear, there's lots of fluttering in the abdomen, and maybe contraction in the throat, tightening in the jaw. There's all kinds of feedback into the body. So those sensations may also be unpleasant, which then would compound the unpleasantness. So was there a question beyond that?
I guess what I'm getting at is that something that the mind can release because it's not like a true physical pain, or is that something like you treat it like a true physical pain, but you just kind of don't?
Well, as I think that description of the mind letting go of the, you know, the kind of the holding, and then the whole rest of the body just suddenly like, oh, it's gone. All that physical pain is gone. I mean, you treat it as... I would just explore it as physical pain, as it feels. I mean, sometimes we don't really know what's body and mind, as this example gives. So, you know, so there's sadness and there's a feeling of heaviness. So noticing, okay, there's heaviness. Is it unpleasant? Is it pleasant? Maybe even possibly pleasant. I mean, I, at one point, being ill, this was an interesting exploration. I was sick. And exploring the body, the pleasantness and unpleasantness of the body when I was sick. And it wasn't a really serious illness. I think I had a cold. And so, you know, I couldn't breathe very well, so that was unpleasant. I had a sore throat, that was unpleasant. But there were sensations in the body. You know, kind of the body actually felt pretty relaxed. And that was really pleasant. So I found it very interesting that to explore what's pleasant and what's unpleasant in the experience. Things that we might typically think of as like, well, this whole experience is unpleasant. Being sick is unpleasant. Some aspects may be pleasant, some may be unpleasant. So it's an interesting exploration. We'll react to the unpleasant ones. You know, we will, if we don't notice them as unpleasant, we will subsequently react. And so if the sadness brings a feeling of heaviness, and that feeling of heaviness feels threatening to us, we might then react to that with yet more mental reactivity of fear. So there's the sadness, which feels the heaviness, and then there's the threatening feeling of heaviness, and then there's the fear that's on top of the sadness, and then that will produce its own sensations, and then we may react to those experiences. So just be with what you can, you know, be. It's really helpful to come into the body and just notice the bodily sensations and see if you can let go of the thoughts around them. Just be willing to, okay, here's what's happening in the body. It's a very helpful exploration.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you for a wonderful talk. My question is there any value in staying with the experience that generates the dukkha? For example, if you're in front of the Starbucks, and would there be any value in just staying there instead of driving and having the whatever trigger the dukkha so out of the way? And for example, currently I'm looking at one person who generates, where I find myself irritated very often when I'm in the presence of this person. And I'm on purpose not avoiding being in the presence of this person so that I can have a chance to look at what's happening inside of me and what is it exactly that I'm clinging to.
Yes.
So is there any value in on purpose exposing myself to that experience?
I would say it depends on the situation, whether it's valuable or not. And this is where it takes discernment in our own minds about what's going on for us, whether it's helpful for us to do that or not. So in your example, it sounds like you are able to make an exploration of the irritation when you're in the presence of this person. It sounds like you're interested in exploring it. That's really great. I mean, that's helpful to keep putting yourself in that place to be able to explore that. There might be times that you find, you know, there, conditions change, right? So there might be times, maybe you don't get enough sleep or you're really hungry one day and you find those conditions make it much harder for you to be able to be with the irritation. So you might begin to recognize that there's certain times where, okay, maybe if I've got an option right now because I'm in a state where I'm going to be triggered beyond what I can be present for, maybe I shouldn't go there. So it's using discernment to know when you can be mindful for it and when you kind of get lost into it. That's kind of my basic discernment check, is can I be mindful of this experience? Can I be present for it? Or does trying to be mindful of it actually put me in the terrain of getting sucked into the stories and the irritation. So, you know, if it might be that at certain times you find that the mindfulness isn't quite strong enough, and, you know, you just get pulled into the story of the irritation, and it just increases the irritation. If you find that happening, you might see if you can draw the conversation to a close skillfully and then get yourself out of the situation. As long as you can be mindful for it, be with it. Certain things, like the Starbucks thing, you know, I don't think there's any, you know, with that kind of situation, I don't think it would have served me to, you know, well, let me sit through another few changes of lights. And I don't know about that, but another exploration that you can make, so to put this in a fuller context, if you find that there's a situation happening that you don't have a lot of choice in, you know, maybe this person you couldn't avoid. Maybe this person is your boss, you know, so you don't have any choice about whether you have to meet with them or not. So, and they still trigger you, and it's not easy to be present for them, you know, so that you're kind of just at the mercy of getting stuck in your patterns and habits when you go into the situation. When that kind of thing happens, one thing you can play with is when you're away from them, you know, when you're at home, you might try exploring, bringing up, so get into meditation, allow yourself to settle into meditation, and then allow yourself to bring up in your mind, create an image of the situation that constructs that difficulty. And then, having that constructed in your mind, you'll probably start to feel the feelings. Because of the mind-body interaction. You think a thought, your body will often respond. And so in that situation, you can let go immediately of the situation and then take the time to feel the feelings. And that will give you the practice in feeling the feelings that will then maybe carry into the situation when it's happening in real time. So you can explore it in that way too. Maybe one more, if there's one more. No, up here.
You were talking earlier about suffering over someone that was several thousand miles away. I was having a thought earlier today that I was causing myself incredible suffering of shame and fear and panic about something that happened 30 years ago. And it's like, wow.
It is like wow.
The mind is almost like a schizoid thing. It's like, what the heck are you doing here? So I mostly wanted to reinforce what you were saying. It was a wonderful Dharma talk on the topic. You know, if this was in a religious setting, I would have been shouting amen every couple of, because I was relating, just the way you were explaining, I was just relating to so much of it.
Uh-huh.
And I go to a lot of sitting groups. I'm mostly in the Oakland and Spirit Rock area. And I go to sitting groups because the daily suffering that I go through, the suffering I'm causing myself of what did that person mean by that, and is this person going to call me back, why didn't that contractor show up? When I go into a sitting group, that stops because I get very settled. I have a very blissful kind of experience. So I'm sitting here, and I'm suddenly realizing the meditation's over. I feel very relaxed. And there's a part of me that says, okay, you know, why don't you just, okay, you've had a nice meditation. Why don't you just leave? And it's like, well, why do I want to leave? Well, I'm feeling a little antsy. You know, I there's something else I could be doing. And it's like, hello. You know, so I just sat here noticing, and it's like, wow, this is another form of suffering,
yep.
Much more subtle, and I'm just sitting there with it, don't like it at all. So it's just like breathing. It's like, okay, where is it in the body? What's it feel like? You know, I'm feeling jumpy. Where, you know, it's in my knees. You know, it's like, you know, what? And just notice it and breathe through it. And like a few minutes later, it's like I've forgotten about it.
Oh, that's so great.
Something else may come up.
Yep.
And it's just a process, and it takes time. But it's through this contrast of going to sitting groups, experiencing the world, being here, noticing this, just coming back to noticing the subtleties of it, from the very gross, the Starbucks thing, My thing was, and the last thing I wanted to say is, it's we usually think of the stress and suffering as a negative, and you'd mention, I observed that sometimes the great joy in my life can be a form of suffering, or quote-unquote great joy. Back in 2005, I discovered I had a really great credit rating, and I could get, for no money down, and I bought three houses and had a deposit on a fourth, and because the thought of doing it, this rush of, I got really charged, and it was like this giddiness. Now I realize giddiness, you know, not a pure, not, I can't rely, I can't trust.
Yes.
Irrational
excitement,
exuberance.
Giddiness, exuberance. Those are all.
Irrational exuberance.
Yep.
And man, I was buying up, you know, two, three places in Palm Springs, one place in Oakland. And then, you know, you could figure out the rest of the story. I don't own any of the properties anymore.
So life
has gotten much simpler, less suffering in that regard. But that was such a great example of how I couldn't trust.
Yes.
You know, this is great. I can do this. This is exciting.
Yes. Yes.
And so thank you. I hope to be here. I'm working more in this area, so hope to come to here more often.
Good.
You have a beautiful, beautiful center here. Really envious to what we don't have up there. So congratulations on the center, and thanks for a great talk.
Thank you. Thank you. And I won't be here next week. I'll be teaching a retreat at Spirit Rock. But the following week, I'll actually go into more of what you're talking about. That's the next elaboration on dukkha is just that side of things. So we need to stop. Thank you all for your participation and your attention.